It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Within this old house live two residents. One of them is John Russell, composer, professor. The other has been dead for over 70 years.
Claire, I'd like to talk to you about the house.
Did you die in this house?
How did you die?
Whatever it is trying desperately to communicate. What is it in that house, Claire? What is it doing? Why is it trying to reach me?
It's a hand.
Something of the senator's. He wants it back.
Many films will frighten you, but only a few can really terrify you. The Changeling, an experience beyond total fear.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? And if you're listening to this about the time that it drops, happy Halloween, because it's only a couple of days away. Now, as is our usual fare, we are doing a Halloween episode, and who better to celebrate the Eve of All Hallows than my good buddy and partner, Mr. Sean Whalen.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you. And who else would it be better than to my other good friend and buddy and partner, Mr. Scott Gardner.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Happy Halloween.
Scott's costume for this Halloween is a host of Is It Yours? Although you've been a frequent guest of late.
Yeah, I'm loving it. I'm loving it. I love talking movies.
I hope the listeners love it as much as we do.
Yeah, all right.
But at Scott's suggestion, today we are covering the 1980 George C. Scott film, The Changeling. And while I will keep a lot of my thoughts undercover for now, this is the first time I ever saw it. I've heard of it in the past. I've never sat down and watched it. And I'm just going to say it's a little different than I anticipated.
That is
not to say that it is bad. It is, you know, it's different from the films that I expect when I look at a horror movie.
Okay.
This almost had the feel to me of having horror elements in a police procedural story. So it's definitely, you know, I can almost feel, you know, Columbo handling this particular mystery. It had the feel for me, and this is not meant to be pejorative, but it had the feel for me of a TV movie. You know, there were a lot of movies in the 70s that were, you know, I don't want to say The Night Stalker, because that was definitely more pure horror than this. But there's one movie that I have fond memories of from the 1970s, a TV movie called Crowhaven Farm. And in that movie, it starred Hope Lang, and she basically is reincarnated from the Salem witch trials. And she's kind of mentally going back and forth, and there's other people around her who've been reincarnated. And there's not as much in the way of active horror as there is in a horror feel. And that's kind of what I feel like we got in this movie. And I think that's why I have the TV movie feeling about it. And I don't want to go too much further into that until I hear kind of your thoughts a little bit, because I don't want to, I don't want to give you everything I've thought of, and then I'll have nothing to say for the rest of the episode. So let's go to Sean. Is this your first viewing of this as well?
Totally my first viewing. And I'm anxious to talk about this one, because I think it's going to be an interesting film to discuss as a group, because it's unique. I love horror films. I'm a big Stephen King fan. I love reading his work. I've read Clive Barker, you know, stuff like that. So, I mean, this is a genre I enjoy, and I've enjoyed films growing up. This is very different than, so I grew up watching 80s horror. I don't know how I missed this one, because it seems like something that would have eventually come my way. But I, you know, I'm used to like Friday the 13th, Your's Nightmare, you know, later on Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween, you know, those type of movies. This is very different than that. I actually like it because it's different than that. There's certain disturbing elements in this one that really hit me. But sometimes when I say disturbing, it's like off-putting, as in I don't like the film because of it. It was disturbing appropriately so because of the story being told here. So it's going to be interesting to talk about that sequence. You know, I mean, there's a certain sequence that appears in multiple ways that we'll get to talking about in this that kind of hits me that way. But it was a compelling story, and I'm anxious to talk about this one, because not having seen it before, it was a nice surprise.
So now, Scott, since you recommended this, give us a little of your history with it.
For a change, I remember exactly how I discovered this movie. So this would have been early 90s, probably 90, 91, 92, somewhere in that stretch. So I had just broken up with a longtime girlfriend of mine, and I was working for a company called Saturday Matinee, which was a video retail place that we sold videotapes. This was in the infancy of video sales, when most people would walk in and go, "How do you rent these?" And you'd go, "Well, these are for sale." And they'd go, "Oh, thanks," and walk back out the door type of thing. So anyway, as I worked for them and kind of moved up the ladder with them, I would go around the northern area of New York and help them set up new stores. And I was helping them set up a store in the Carousel Mall in Syracuse, New York. And I met this girl there that was going to be one of the, I don't know, she was a manager, assistant manager, something. And we ended up having a relationship that was a horrible relationship. She turned out to be quite the psychotic. she's the psycho ex-girlfriend. Anyway, if anything good came out of that relationship, was that she was always trying to expand my movie parameters, because I'm not a horror guy. I've never been a horror guy. I don't like slasher films. I've never seen any of the Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street. That's just not my jam. But she said, well, what would you, you know, what's a good scary movie to you? And I said, well, you know, I like, you know, something that's not gory or anything, but that just gives you the chills, you know, like a good ghost story. And she goes, I got just the movie. And I remember we rented it from, I think it was the Syracuse Public Library of all places. I remember it was a library. It was either Syracuse or Liverpool Library. We took it home and watched it. And I was just blown away. I instantly fell in love with it. This is my favorite, like, tell me a spooky story movie. And it's funny, Paul, that you said, you know, the thing that reminds you like of both like a TV movie and like a police procedural, because you know what this really reminds me of? This is like a feature length episode of Unsolved Mysteries is what it feels like to me. And I love it for that aspect. That show, especially the opener of that show with that creepy ass music, just the music of that show would already give me the chills and already put me in the right vibe. And this movie does that. It's not, I mean, there's very little blood, there's very little gore, but it just gives you the creeps.
Yeah.
And I love that feel about it. It's, you know, if you're expecting, you know, if you're a horror person, I would love to know like a horror person's perspective on this, because I'd kind of expect they'd probably find it like boring and probably hate it because there's no blood and guts. There's no jump scares. There's nothing like that. It's totally about the feel that it gives you. And the feeling it gives me is it creeps me out. It makes me kind of sad because it's not a happy story. And it's just that feel of, get out of that house, you know, that sort of thing. And I love it.
Oh, well, it's, I mean, there are subgenres to the horror movie category. And, you know, we've mentioned the slasher movies, and I think that's probably the most common conception of horror movie. But then you have, you know, you have like your Universal Monsters. Those are horror movies. Right. You know, then, and you have your ghost stories, that's where this would fall. Your supernatural thrillers, which could kind of be a Venn diagram having this in it and some other things. But there's different types. So to pigeonhole somebody as a horror fan and say, well, what do you think of this one? Because this is a horror movie, I think might be oversimplifying it. I think you have to be within the genre able to shift to this type of movie. And you know, I looked in my very, very detailed research that I do for just about every show. I read the Wikipedia page, and it's under critical response. It mentions Roger Ebert said something, and here I'm just going to read: if it only took craftsmanship to make a haunted house movie, The Changeling would be a great one. It has all the technical requirements, beginning with the haunted house itself. The film does have some interesting ideas, but it doesn't have that sneaky sense of awful things about to happen. Scott makes the hero so rational, normal, and self-possessed that we never feel he's in real danger. We go through this movie with too much confidence. Now, I get what he's saying, but I think he was looking for a different type of horror movie than what we got here.
Right.
I think that's the problem. And I think he acknowledges that it's very well put together. The acting is very good. And, you know, we'll get into some of the details with all of that. The story is a little subtle, and it's not meant to make you sit on the edge of the chair and be afraid that somebody behind you is going to stick an ice pick in the back of your neck. It's meant to just make you kind of get, you know, just what I always remember them calling, you know, get the willies. Where, you know, you just kind of feel just a little creeped out. And when you go to sleep that night, you're just thinking about it a little bit, and you're not afraid that the ghost of Joseph is going to come into your house, but you're just a little creeped out. And I think that was very effective in this movie. I think that was well done. I think possibly the lack of gore and the lack of true intensity at parts is what gave it a little bit of the TV movie feel for me. But again, I don't want to say that that's a pejorative. That's not necessarily negative. So, you know, there have been some TV movies that are among my favorites. I mentioned The Night Stalker earlier. You know, I've reviewed on this show Duel. You know, there are plenty of TV movies that I would say, you know, rank as great. Now, I'm not going to say I'm ranking this as great, but I'm saying I'm not closing the door and I'm open-minded to movies of this nature. I don't want to overstate my take on it either. I thought, again, the story was subtle. And you know what's interesting? You're saying the unsolved mysteries aspect of it, because they even say during the movie at one point, well, who's going to, you know, what authorities are really going to care about a murder that took place in 1917, you know, or whatever year it was that it took place.
Right.
You know, this isn't something where, you know, it's got just that general feel to it. It's got the mystery feel. You're wondering why it's going on. To me, the most unbelievable thing is this recently widowed man who lost his daughter as well and is living alone buys this giant Gothic house. You know, when he could probably just live in an apartment. But other than that, you know, it's fun to see the mystery unravel as it does. And then I think we've talked about this in a recent Hitchcock one. They kind of solve the mystery early, but then leave it to the characters to actually show what they believe happened. You know, after the seance, what's Georgie Scott's name in this? I forgot now. John Russell he's pretty much works out what happened pretty quickly and figures it all out. Now it's a matter of proving it. And that's where he's reaching, you know, having opposition and having to deal with that. And ultimately, you know, the resolution is supernatural in nature and, you know, pretty cool.
I think one of the things that I enjoyed about the unfolding mystery, though, was it looked like one thing and it had another layer to it.
Yeah.
Like the death of the boy, Joseph, Joseph was murdered. Okay. The added layer of him being replaced by somebody else, I was expecting this to be a movie where we're going after the dad that committed the murder. Instead, what's happening is that guy's long gone. And the truth is the replacement is who's still in existence. It is actually Joseph's names, you know, he's taken the name of, you know, his replacement is still around, which I thought was kind of a unique approach, you know, because it's not really a true revenge story. Because here, this person who replaced, he didn't actually, he's kind of a victim in his own way. Because he didn't do this. This was one of those things where just because he happened to be an orphan, he wound up being able to be plugged into this. Now, some of that part that's nebulous is how much did he actually know? You know,
that's what I was just going to say.
I think there are, as the movie's unfolding, it leaves you, and I actually like this. I love when movies like this are smart and they go, we're not going to spell everything out for you. We want you to kind of use your imagination and kind of like be left with the conversation. And that's where this film kind of works for me, that you mentioned, Paul, before there being different genres to horror. I like ones like this, too, where like, get thinking a little bit. Make me question what's going on at the end. I'm still questioning how much did he actually know?
Well, my take on it, just to jump in on you, I'm sorry, but at the end, you know, almost at the very end of the movie, when the faux Joseph is kind of reliving the murder, the look on his face as it's happening says to me he didn't know.
One of the things I really like about this is I think it's open to your own interpretation. And I love movies like that most of the time where they
within reason.
Yeah, within reason. Exactly. You know, your 2001s, that sort of thing. But this one here is interesting because every time I watch it, I end up with a different perspective about that whole thing. Like, how much did the old man know and that sort of thing. And this time around rewatching it, I focused a little bit more on Russell's speech to him where he says, you suspected something was wrong all your life. And I think that's kind of the clue to us, the viewer, of the old man's perspective is that I clearly don't believe that he knew that the real Joseph was murdered by his father. I don't believe he knew anything of that. But I think that there was always something in the back of his mind that didn't add up, and that he may have known that he wasn't really Joseph Carmichael, but that may have been as far as it went, type of thing. So this whole thing with him, you know, his father being accused by Russell of the murder, and I think his outrage in that is genuine, because he didn't know any of that. So yeah, in a large sort of way, he is a victim as well, in that aspect. And I want to circle back to that a little bit later, because, I've always had questions about, how it plays out in that sort of like revenge aspect, and how fair was that to him, because Joseph, the ghost Joseph, is a child. And I think it's important to remember that how this all plays out very much plays out like an angry child. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have a logic to it other than, a child lashing out, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to touch on something that Sean had brought up. You know, you'd started to say about, you know, how the movie kind of fakes you out. And what I thought you were going to mention was there's another fake out even earlier than that, with where they're doing their research and they discover that a child, a girl, was killed in the house. And the movie leads you down that path like, oh, this is, you know, John has lost his daughter. This is going to turn out to be the ghost of a little girl that's reaching out to him through that. And it even, when they have the seance and the medium says something in this house is reaching out to you through your loss, it's leading you that way only to discover, oh, wait, the presence in this house is not that girl. It's not that it's a child, but it's not that child. And that, I always thought that was really interesting and clever as well.
And you're right, there's multiple fake outs, because that part I really liked too, because they were doing like his reaction to the ball and those type of pieces where he kept having the flashback memories. I think the movie starting off with the way that he witnessed the death of his wife and daughter was powerful, because it wasn't just that he lost them. He saw it and he felt trapped. He was in that phone booth. He's watching this unfold and almost paralyzed. By what he was witnessing there. And George C. Scott, one of the things I got to say, did either of you see The Exorcist 3 with him?
I don't think so.
Bits and pieces. I've never seen it from beginning to end.
So for me personally, it's an example of a movie where the third movie, like I think stepped up storytelling, if that makes any sense. I thought George C. Scott played a great role in that too. And I'm revealing right now that I really liked George C. Scott in this. His acting, I thought, was top notch. As playing a person who's witnessed his wife and daughter pass, but is trying to move on and live life, but is carrying that baggage with him, I thought they did it in a really balanced way where it wasn't over the top. I really felt like he felt like a real character. And, you know, he's got his music career to kind of fall back on and embrace. And clearly that is something that's helping him therapeutically try to live life. Even when he goes into that classroom and there's like, it was supposed to be like 23 and it was a full house. And you see like elements of his personality where he's joking around with the room, you know, as far as, you know, whether or not he can deliver to their expectations. It showed the fact that this is not somebody who's always lost in loss. There is somebody who has other aspects of their personality that is able to play out. And I quite liked that. I'm like, okay, this is a guy I can get behind and feel something for, which was helpful in kind of going. Sometimes in a movie, you get lost in the fact that who's my latch on character? Like, who's somebody that I'm going to want to actually like and enjoy going on the journey with? And I actually quite liked him.
Yeah.
which is something that I think is really critical for a movie like this, where so much is going on that like is so at times hard to watch appropriately. I mean, I think the story called for that. So it sounds like you're being critical when you're saying I'm not. I actually felt that that was appropriate to the story being told, but he carried me through all that where I was running along with him. I also say if I'm doing a seance, do not turn off the lights. Turn off, like, yeah. When was the last time you saw in a movie a seance happen where they turn off the lights and it turns out well? It just doesn't. If the ghost isn't going to show up with a little bit of lights on, probably shouldn't. I'm just saying.
I did think he seemed a little old to be that girl's father at the beginning. And then there was a point where I was questioning, well, do you even need to have this in the story? Because that isn't, you know, that's really a little bit of a misdirection that you think it's going to go from there and it doesn't. But it does give the sub background story. And I was going to say subtext, but I think it's more background story to understand his loss and to understand why he is, you know, somebody that this ghost of Joseph could connect to because he experienced that loss. So it kind of grounds the character and it gives it, you know, gives him something. I don't know if it would have played better if the girl had been, you know, mid teens instead of a preteen. I don't know, you know, maybe it would have had the same effect, but I guess they wanted to have the girl be the, you know, similar in age to Joseph. And I think, you know, that was it. So he seemed, you know, just a touch old for this, but he's such a good actor. And I think you hit on a good point, Sean, because, again, going to the Roger Ebert, you know, you don't feel like he himself is in true danger. And that almost gives him this avuncular feel where he's taking you by the hand and he's bringing you through the story and you feel safe because you're with him. it's you know, a little bit of a different way to look at a horror movie, but you're looking at this one and you're not trying to feel that you're him. You know, he's not the representation of you in the movie. He's the person bringing you through the movie.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's different from what, you know, usually you want somebody who you could relate to that you think, oh, well, if I was in this situation, what would I do? In this one, you're almost saying, well, you know, where do you suggest we go, George C. Scott? <You know>? Oh, you want to dig down there? Okay, let's go down there and see what's there. It's, you know, I had looked at the cast beforehand, and if I have one disappointment in it, I've long been a fan of John Colicos, and, you know, from his work on Star Trek, and he had been on, I'm almost embarrassed to admit that I know him from this, but he had been on General Hospital. You know, I've gotten a kick out of him in everything I've ever seen him in, and I would have liked for him to have had a bigger part in this. Mm. Probably my only disappointment is that his part was much smaller than I anticipated.
That shocked him, though. I'm hoping people listening to this have seen it. And if you haven't seen it, if you got this far into it and you haven't seen the movie, go watch it first and then listen to this, because we're going to spoil things. But that final shot of him where he's upside down and dead and you're seeing him through the wood, that creeps me out.
Yes.
Because he's kind of a weird looking dude to begin with. But that shot and the expression of shock on his dead face is just, yeah, that sticks with me in this.
Yeah, movie. Absolutely.
And a critical piece with that one too is usually when those deaths happen, it's explainable. What I loved is they made it a point to say it wasn't.
Right.
It just happened.
The car was flipped over. It didn't make any sense. There was no weather condition, no nothing that would have generated that happening. And that's unique. That doesn't happen very often in film, and I really love that distinction because it added another creep factor to, like, you know, Joseph's got a thing going on.
that also lends into my thing about, you know, the angry child, because it bothers me, and I think it should bother you, that DeWitt dies. I mean, he's not really a likable character, and he's threatening our hero in this. But at the end of the day, he is a cop doing his job, and he's killed for it. And that's really harsh. But you have to remember that the force that kills him is an angry child. You know, he's angry about what has happened to him. And this man is a threat to John and what's happening in this situation, you know, to the resolution that Joseph, you know, the ghost of Joseph is after. So he's got to go. And that's a horror element, you know, on a whole nother level.
Joseph is an angry child lashing out, which is even seen because he doesn't kill her, but he throws, what's her name, Claire Norman down the stairs.
Yeah.
And she's there's nothing evil in her character at all. There's nothing even in her character that's getting in the way of this mystery. She's trying to help John Russell to solve the mystery. But, you know, as a child, he sees her in the way for a moment and he's like, you know, get out of the way, and shoves her down the stairs.
Yeah.
And his modeling of how you handle things that are in the way is you drown them, you destroy them. Like, look what happened to him. It's still something that, if we're going off the angry child theory, this is a kid who does not understand what happened to him and why.
Right.
It's all of a sudden this happened in such a shocking circumstance. It's why I said earlier that was so disturbing, that sequence with him. But I think you don't understand, like, you're not carried through the motivation if you don't see what happened there. Because, I mean, the disturbing part is anytime, you know, violence against a child or something like that is something that just for all of us should be something that's very disturbing. It was used effectively in this movie, though, to make you horrified. And mm-hmm. and in many ways, it's strange to be sympathetic for a ghost who is lashing out like this. But that, I think, is an interesting layer where you can, like, go, I get why Joseph's angry. And as a kid, angry and just does not understand any aspect of compassion in some cases, because that wasn't modeled for him. It was that part, I think, was really a jarring and effective.
Absolutely.
Agreed. I don't know. You know, this is the second George C. Scott movie that Sean and I have done in a relatively short period of time. We did Day of the Dolphin not too long ago. And Trish Van Devere is his co-star in both. And, you know, for anybody who doesn't know, she was also Mrs. George C. Scott.
Yeah.
So, you know, I get a kick out of that, you know, when the couples make movies together and make good movies together. And they're not always a couple in the movie.
I like her in this, and I think she's very attractive. I don't think I knew that until, you know, doing, you know, some homework on the movie, you know, for the show, that she was his real life wife. If I knew that before, I'd forgotten it. I off the top of my head, I don't think I've ever seen her in anything else, but I really like her in this. I like that she, you know, they have almost an instant. Well, I was going to say an instant attraction. I think she's instantly attracted to him. He seems a little slow in the uptake, honestly. But then again, you know, he's a man that's, you know, in mourning and that sort of thing. But I like that she seems pretty much taken with him right from the get-go. And I like that she's, you know, she's there for him. She's supportive for him and everything. And she's got a couple really good moments. The moment where she's having the bad reaction to the voice on the tape and then sees the wheelchair at the top of the stairs. That, to me, that's a great moment. It's just top-notch acting because, you know, watching that scene, knowing it's coming, I'm watching it on a different level, and she still completely sells it that this is something that's just happened, and it's startling, and it freezes her in her tracks. That's just a sign of a really good actor, and that's a really good moment. The way she totally sells that scene, I like that.
The red ball, when he dumped it off the bridge, was something that really stood out for me as an effective sequence, because, you know, he comes back and that ball. it was one of those where you knew what was going to happen. Like, it was pretty much telegraphed, but then when it happens, the way it was, the use of sound in this film, I thought was really well done. Piano key, music, just sound effects, I thought was something that was really stood out for me. It doesn't always in all films. This one in particular, it did. The ball bouncing down the stairs, the thumping of, you know, him beating against the bathtub. Things like that that kept appearing throughout the film added a sense of suspense. But when that ball came down the stairs, I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, you know, that would have been the point in time that I'm like, Motel 6 sounds really good to me right about now. you know, this house is beautiful and all that, but nothing is that beautiful. It's like, if you kid, you want the ball to stay here, you keep it. I'm gone.
Back in Eddie Murphy's stand-up bit, he talked about the movie The Amityville Horror. And he was saying, like, they get there. Oh, this place is beautiful, baby. We're going to stay here. We're going to have kids. We're going to do everything. Get out. Too bad we can't live here.
You know, I suspect that's why, you know, going back to, you know, seeing the tragedy at the beginning of the movie, witnessing it along with him, the age of his daughter, just all those elements. It finally kind of clicked for me on this viewing why all that's there, because one of I haven't really heard any criticisms in this movie, but I've read some, and one of the criticisms is exactly that. Like, once all this creepy stuff starts to happen, why doesn't he just leave? And I think part of it is that there's a couple really good scenes that remind you what this man's going through psychologically. And one of them is where he relives the accident in his nightmares and he wakes up sobbing in the morning, and then he hears the banging for the first time he hears it. And then later in the movie where he goes on the horse ride with Claire, and then he has the morose moment where the horses have reminded him of his daughter, and then he's very down. I like those moments, and it reminds you that there are moments in the movie where, I'm not talking about his acting, but just his mood and his demeanor are a little, I don't know what the word is, not wooden, because that sounds like I'm talking about his acting, but just his emotional state is a little detached. Like, he's not really showing any emotion. He's just kind of stoic. And it's because he's dealing with all this. He's going through all this. And I think on a certain level, he's operating in a morose fog. Mm. And I think that morose fog is what helps him deal with these weird things as they start to happen. And it keeps him from running out of the house screaming like a normal person would do, because he's not really all, you know what I mean? He's not completely there, if you know what I'm saying. Does that make sense? Does that follow?
That does make sense. But I also had the sense, and I could be wrong, but I also had the sense that he didn't feel directly threatened by what was going on, and that perhaps he interpreted it as a soul reaching out to him for help, which is ultimately what it was.
Right. Right.
I think you nailed some of this before, too, when you were talking about the first swerve. When he thought it was the girl at first, I felt like he was connecting that with his daughter.
Right.
And he felt like there was that outreach initially. And then I think what was carrying him through later was this need to know why. Why me? And also, what are you trying to say to me? And I think he had been hooked in at that point in time by, you know, the connection to his daughter at first. I loved that I wanted to see the end of the story. And I mean, that's an important part of any suspense story, you know, where there's a suspense element to it is, do you care about seeing the like, where is this going? And I did throughout this journey. And a big part of that was him. It was, I was getting what he was saying. It's like, why me? Why, you know, what are you trying to say to me? What are you trying to connect with? And I think that's what kept him there throughout it when the crazy stuff was going on.
Have you guys seen The Haunting from I think it's like 1960 or thereabouts. It's an old black and white haunted house movie. It was remade fairly recently as The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix. Yeah. There's an effect both in the original movie and used briefly in The Haunting of Hill House that's this same thing as the bathtub in this, the bang, 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 the rhythmic, but it's done huge, like really reverberating and just, you know, a noise you can't escape type of thing. And there's a great, I think it's on YouTube. I could be wrong. I saw it from archives at Disney, but there was an interview. It was a walkthrough tour of the Haunted Mansion by Imagineer Tony Baxter. Mm-hmm. And he was talking, you know, all about the history of the Haunted Mansion and work that they wanted to do or that they had done when they've done refurbishments and things like that. And he was talking about how much of the Haunted Mansion was actually based on that movie, The Haunting. And he said one of his favorite effects from that movie was that bang, bang, bang. And he said if he had his druthers in one of the refurbishments, they would have added that at some point to the Haunted Mansion because he thought it was so effective and so scary. And I've always wondered, you know, has he seen this movie as well? Because this does the same thing. And I like that there's, in The Haunting, I don't remember there ever being an explanation for that noise. But in this, the noise is perfectly logical because it's the noise of the child banging on the sides of the metal bathtub as he's being drowned. And I love that. It's, to me, that's one of the most haunting elements of the film is that recurring noise exactly at the time that he was murdered. That's, you know, and that's a classic haunted house, you know, element too. You know, if you read old haunted house stories, you know, the rhythmic nature and the repetition, you know, every night or every, you know, October, whatever, you know, some year this happens type of thing, you know, that repeating nature. I like that.
The things that they don't show you in this, or, you know, or don't necessarily outwardly explain are kind of like the sequence where the medium arrived. This is leading into Joseph's reveal. You know, we finally get the idea this is Joseph, not the daughter. You know, we're getting that confirmation. The medium arrives, immediately goes upstairs, looks into the attic. She shut the door. And I double checked to make sure that was what happened because it was one of those things where with what happens later, I thought she shut the door. She sure did. They were gathering around the table downstairs. The door was open and it clearly looked like something was disturbed. I mean, very good use of camera angles. Even the dust on the floor and all those pieces, you know, were clearly an element of that type of thing. It was really effective. You aren't seeing anything gory or some horrific monster in those sequences, but it's what you don't see that's captivating there. You know something big is going on in that moment. The music was a star in that sequence. The piano keys, the building to the suspense, glass shattering on the cat. You know, all those pieces that were happening in that sequence with the Joseph reveal was great. And then the attic door closing again after the event. It was all things that the people downstairs did not see. We got to see as the viewers. But it was a really effective journey, adding that horror element to it, but a very different kind. And I'm always a fan of that kind of stuff where it was like, ooh, that was just very, very well done. 1980, you know, I mean, nowadays we take for granted things that can be done with CGI and all kinds of effects and things like that. In 80, they delivered that really effectively with practical effects that felt very, very real.
Well, see, you know, you mentioned 1980, and what I think is they wouldn't make this movie in 2024 or 2025 because it is a little too subtle, and it is a little, it's not quite bombastic enough, and there's not enough, you know, jump scenes in it. This isn't the kind of horror movie that they make now. This is something you might see on the TV series American Horror Story, but you would not
you would not get a theatrical release for a movie like this. And the nature of the theater is different now than it was in 1980. In 1980, I don't remember the exact dollar amount, but it's probably you plop down $5 and you go in and you see the movie. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a bank breaker. Now you want to go to the movies, you know, with your wife, just for the two seats, you're spending $50. It's, mm-hmm. you know, you need something that's going to be a major theatrical event to make you go to the movies. Otherwise you might as well watch it at home. There's really, you know, less point in going to the theater nowadays for a small movie. And this is a small movie. You mentioned the music before, and anytime I review a movie with Scott Gardner, I try to pay special attention to the score. I do not think this was a score that I would find myself driving around in the car listening to, but I did think it was exceptionally effective. I thought there were scenes when it added to the suspense in scenes, and it added to the mood, and it created an atmosphere. So I did think it was very, very well paired with the film that it was made for. So in that respect, I give the score high grades.
Because would you play it if you were upside down in the car?
I might play it if you were drowning me.
So it's funny you say you wouldn't drive around listening to it, because I did that this week. This is it's funny because I generally, when I listen to music when I'm driving, which is pretty much every single day, I just put my phone on just, you know, random, just play everything in my library, but just completely at random. And invariably when tracks from the Changeling come up, I skip, because this isn't casual listening. This isn't, you know, tracks or an album that I'd want. And it has such a, both a haunting nature to it, but also a very tragic nature to it. I don't want it to bring me down. So listening to they recently, and by recently I say within the last 20 years, because I don't remember the exact year, but they released finally the complete score on two discs. And so I re-listened to it, because it'd been a long time since I'd listened to it, just standalone, just listened to it for enjoyment. It is a really good album, but it's not the kind of thing that you can just listen to casually. This is definitely a score that is meant to be part of this movie. But being part of the movie, one of the things that really occurred to me, and I love that Sean kind of hit on this before, is that I think it's very appropriate that we're reviewing this on Is It Jaws? Because it shares something very special in common with Jaws, which is in Jaws, primarily, I guess, according to legend, because the shark just didn't work. The shark in Jaws is the camera and the music. The camera and the music are the threat, not the monster, not the shark, most of the time. The same thing happens in The Changeling. You never see Joseph. If this were made modern, as we were just talking about, if this was a, you know, remade today, then you'd get Ghost Joseph at some point. And I wouldn't want to see that. This works so much more effectively because you don't see the monster. And what you get instead is you get these really creepy, you know, the camera sweeping down in very tight shots, you know, the camera coming down the stairs, you know, leaving the attic room and coming down the stairs and peering at everybody at the table for the seance. And the music together with that camera work, that's your monster. That's your ghost right there. So you don't need the jump scares. You don't need to see a ghostly apparition. You're feeling it in that, the way those shots are designed. And in the few moments where, okay, you need to see the shark to be reminded it's there, you get that with the ball, with the wheelchair, and then with the big wheelchair chase, which I frankly have always found kind of silly. But it does work as well. I mean, it is scary, but it's also a little silly too. But those elements, I think that's what makes it all work. I think if you actually saw apparitions, it would take something away from it, because what you don't see is always scarier than what you do see. Especially in old movies like this, where maybe the effects, you know, wouldn't hold up to whatever your mind is conjuring type of thing.
I definitely agree. And again, I think this is just a little bit of a different kind of horror story. This isn't the kind of horror story that's supposed to make you jump. It's not supposed to be the one that, you know, you're walking from the theater to your car and you're looking behind you to see if there's a killer there. This is the kind where you know, you're fine after you're done watching it. And then later at night when you're laying in bed, you start thinking about it and you get just a little creeped out.
Yeah.
That's the horror movie that we have here.
This is the kind of horror movie that, again, I like best because it reminds me of when I was a little kid. I'm talking like little kid. I remember like being gathered around the family, television set, watching something that was scary. And then it was like you feel that tingle where you got to go use the bathroom. But you're so damn scared, you don't want to walk down that dark hallway by yourself to go use the bathroom, you know, that sort of thing. And that's what much of this movie fills me with. So when I rewatched this the other night, I watched it upstairs in the theater room in the dark completely by myself. And, you know, there's that moment when the movie's done and everything. It's like, I can't turn the lights up fast enough. And I have to leave the lights on all the way down the stairs because I don't want to be in the dark by myself. Walk, you know, that I love movies that do that to you. You know, it's like, you know, that feeling of, you know, something's hiding in the dark waiting, you know, not necessarily waiting to get you, but just waiting to creep you out. Because to me, the moment of the movie that works best for me in that creep factor is the voice on the tape. Mm-hmm. That is my favorite moment of the entire film, because all through the seance, how I interpret George C. Scott's demeanor and facial expressions is that he thinks it's all bullshit. He never says it, but he keeps giving Claire these sidelong glances, and just his whole demeanor says, I don't, why am I even doing this? This is just ridiculous. And if I have any criticisms of the movie, and there's not many, but one of them I do have is that the seance, after the glass shatters, we skip forward in time to where the seance is over and everybody else has gone home. And I feel like that's a mistake. I would have liked a moment where we see the wrap up of the seance and maybe he said outright to Claire, that was a waste of time, or what did that accomplish? You know, something to show his frustration and that he doesn't really believe that anything, you know, substantive happened. But then what we get is him sitting alone in the house in the dark, and he starts to play the tape back, and that's when he hears the voice. And that creeps the shit out of me, because I used to, years ago, I forget what job I was working, but I worked overnights and I used to listen to Coast AM with, well, first it was with Art Bell and then later with George Norrie. And some of my favorite episodes was when they would have this team, I think it was a husband and wife team, I think, that they went around recording what they called EVPs, electronic voice phenomena. And they went to like old houses, cemeteries, morgues, and they would go with a tape recorder and they would just record and then later listen back to this, and they would get some stuff that would just, you know, when you're listening to this on your lunch break at like 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, it would creep you out. And I remember them specifically, they had one that they recorded, I think it was in a morgue. It was either in a morgue or a like a mortuary. And the voice said, plastic eyes. And so they talked to the mortician, and it turned out that corpses are given like plastic under their eyelids to maintain the shape of their eyes because of the way that things start to change and settle and all after the body dies. And so they interpreted it like this ghost was like, aware or maybe even complaining about these plastic eyes. And I mean, I'm telling you, just talking about it gives me goosebumps. So that element of this movie with Joseph's voice on the tape just gives me that same feeling. I feel like they did a really fantastic job of portraying that the way that these people claim that these things happen, where it's recorded, nobody hears it at the time, but then it's only when you play it back on magnetic tape that you discover that something was actually there, something is there. And that I've always been fascinated by that, but not brave enough to ever try it myself, because I'd probably have a heart attack if I actually did discover I'd recorded something like that. I think it would freak me right out.
The only remaining note. Oh, sorry. What?
No, I was just going to say, you were talking before about the actors in this. I didn't know if you had anybody else. There were two other people I thought was worth kind of noting. Roberta Maxwell. She's in it very briefly. She's I don't know what the relationship is. I guess they're just friends of John, but she's in, when John's with that couple at the beginning of the movie and they're talking in like a living room, she's the lady that recommends to John. I think she said something like, I have a friend that restores old houses, and you know, I'll talk to them and see if we can set you up, kind of thing. That's the actress. I always remember her best as the reporter who's investigating the disappearance of Mrs. Poole, who turns out to be Norman Bates's crazy aunt in Psycho 3, if you guys have ever seen Psycho 3. And I just discovered recently, and I can't believe I never pieced it together before, but she was also Olive Oil's mother in Popeye, which I think came out the same year, right? 1980. So quite a range as an actress, but I never pieced together that she was Nana Oil before. That just cracks me up. And then Jane, I presume it's pronounced Jane, is J-A-N-N-E, Jane Mortill. That was the little girl that's being haunted by Joseph, you know, in the well, in her bedroom. She would go on to play Madeline Astor in the 1996 Titanic TV miniseries. George C. Scott played Captain Smith in that series. So they were together again.
Interesting connection.
Yeah, I thought that was neat. There was another Titanic connection in this that I thought was really interesting, is that this score is really weird because it's actually a collaboration with three different composers. So you've got Rick Wilkins and Ken Wanberg, neither one I really know that much about. And then the third guy, and he's credited in the closing credits of the movie simply as having written the music box theme, but he did do a lot more work on the movie than just that, is Howard Blake. And that name always jumped right out to me because Howard Blake did the score to SOS Titanic, which I think may have been a TV movie, but I first ever saw it on TV. That's the one with David Warner is in that one. I'm trying to remember who else is in it. I'm blanking at the moment, but it's one of the better Titanic movies, honestly. But yeah, Howard Blake did the score to that. So yeah, a couple of Titanic connections to the movie as well.
You mentioned the sequence with the little girl at the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important one to note, because that was something that stood out for me as like kind of grounding this as well. I liked the choice that they didn't immediately say, rip up the room.
Right.
I like that the mom was kind of like, I know you want to rip up the room. And she's like, I got to get back to you on that one. And right. Sometimes for expediency, when it's a film, they sometimes rush to the sequence like that. I think one of the things that really struck me in this, which is funny to say with such a supernatural focused movie as this was, the choices to ground certain things made this movie feel, I think, a little more creepy, a little more relatable, because of the fact that decisions that were made, interactions, felt more normal. They felt like
right.
happen right. in the real world. And I really appreciated that, because I think sometimes when you get into this type of thing, it's like, well, we're already going over the top. Let's just keep going. When you choose to keep the right amount of reality there, it adds to me to the creep factor. Of right. it, appropriately so. And I thought that was a really good choice, because when they do disturb that room, there's buckets everywhere, there's dirt everywhere. It like validates the mother's choice to say, I don't know that I want you doing this. So I liked that invasive nature of ripping apart the house to find the well was something that wasn't just like, oh sure, come on in, rip the joint up. I mean, it wasn't until the daughter had the follow-up nightmare and we got to see that piece where mom's like, oh no, get that, whatever you got to do, get that thing out of here. We've already made arrangements to stay somewhere else. And honestly, I'd be surprised to find out that family ever came back into that house again.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's always bugged me a little bit is that we don't really get anything of what was told to the police, because they had to tell them something. You know, how did they know, or how did they discover what reason would you have to tear up your bedroom floor, discover a well that nobody knew existed anymore, and then you end up finding a body in it? So they had to tell them something.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on in the scene with DeWitt, where he confronts John at his house, he does say something to the effect of, and you discovered a body that a ghostly voice told you was there. So evidently he did say something to the police. I feel like it would have been a little more effective if we had been privy to at least some of that, because narratively it just kind of jumps to the next scene and you're not really given anything to like, well, he, you know, again, clearly he would have had to explain himself at least somehow.
Here's what I liked about that. It compromised DeWitt. And let me explain why. Mrs. Norman, who was the clerk, and when they were doing the research and she was not letting them have the file, they were asking for the file. We found out later that she was working with the faux Joseph,
right,
at those sequences. So obviously she clarified for him everything that she'd overheard them talking about in that sequence. Cause she knew already that they were heading down a whole rabbit hole with this whole piece. He clearly was communicating with DeWitt and knew certain pieces that, she had told him and had conveyed them. So DeWitt had an information that the police would know, at least this is how I'm interpreting that. DeWitt had information that the police knew, but also that Joseph would have known from the sources that were coming in. DeWitt was willing to use that to show him, like, listen, you've compromised yourself here. And I can craft a whole narrative here around you that he was trying to bully him. And I really liked that part that he was basically saying, okay, you think you're going to play this game with me right now? I got a whole bunch of information on you right now that, quite frankly, if he did not die in that sequence, it would have been an interesting plot hole, because you're sitting here saying, like, DeWitt's got him. Right. What Joseph did in that sequence really effectively kept John Russell moving forward, because he would not have been able to if DeWitt had been able to continue on at that point, because he had John at that point. Not ethically, but John would have had no defense because of the fact that he did keep information from the police. He did not reveal all the pieces that he knew. He did not reveal the information that he was seeking out the metal. He had already withheld evidence from the police. And I was glad DeWitt called him out on that, because I felt like that was a major piece where I'm like, wow, that added. I was with you. I would have loved to have seen more with DeWitt, because I thought he played a really good role in this. But I also felt like his pathway, there was nowhere else for that to go.
Right.
If that story was going to continue on. But man, did he played an intimidating part for the short period of time that we had him.
Yeah. I liked him much better in this than as a Klingon in Star Trek.
Yes, I agree.
Really, my only other note on this is, is my issue with the my only issue is the ending. I did have a couple other issues, but I think we pretty much covered those. The ending, I've kind of come to grips with it over the years. I do like it. The way I kind of interpret it is that it's kind of symbolic. Like, by revealing to Faux Joseph, I like how you named him that, the full extent of what happened and everything, I feel like Ghost Joseph somehow pulls him, like his ghost or his spirit, into that house. And I always took it that he was basically, he's almost like trading places, or he's placing the correct spirit in the house, if you know what I mean. Like, he's been trapped in that house since he was murdered there by the father. And now he's putting Faux Joseph in his place so that he can rest. Mm-hmm. So basically tying up all loose ends. So I can see that, and I like that. But the last shot of the movie is, you know, the house is burned down, and we see the smoking remains of the house, and we see the wheelchair, and we see the music box. And then the lid to the music box flips open and the music box starts to play. And that's how the movie ends. And I always interpret that as Joseph, Ghost Joseph, is still there. Mm-hmm. And I don't like that, because ultimately what was the point of all this if he's still going to haunt that ground, if he's still not at rest? I thought the point of all this was for him to find peace, for him to reveal what happened, have that solved, and also take revenge on fake Joseph. So if all that was accomplished, why is he still not at rest?
And I don't know. I think it's one of the areas where I think it's intriguing the way the film goes, because the person he really should have enacted revenge on was his father.
Right.
Which... It's one of the things that I enjoyed about this film, was the fact that it was Faux Joseph that was kind of the target, because there was no other choice. I guess, and by the way, I wasn't interpreting it this way till you started asking the question, so I want to be really clear. But I guess the only other piece I could say is, can you ever truly find rest if you don't actually resolve where your real problem lies? His father died and he didn't get to be a part of it. He never got to really enact revenge around the real target of his rage, which should be his father. It should not be the fake Joseph, which you referenced earlier, didn't really do anything. I mean, other than the fact that he may have been suspicious of his adoptive father, but even then, I mean, I like the sequence with him where he was looking at the portrait of his adoptive father, and he's sitting here like really questioning the man, you know, or at least the narrative he's crafted around the man and how that's driven who he is and how he's carried himself. So it was really intriguing.
Do you think that the movie should have given us something on the father? Like, what happened to him? I'm always been curious about that. You know, how did he meet his end? Was Joseph in any way involved in that, or was Joseph cheated?
I'm thinking, if this was a big enough hit, you know, this is turns out to be like the surprise sleeper hit of 1980. There would have been a prequel that would have had something like that in there. And I think, quite frankly, it would have diminished it.
Yeah.
Changeling to the Heretic. Yeah. I can see that.
I think you don't.
I think it's almost better to not know what happened to the father.
I think you don't have the battle between Joseph and the dad until Changeling 7. I think that's really where you pay it off. And it's like the two of them really duke it out. And that's where we get it in there. I think we can really milk this.
Changeling 7, Joseph in New York.
Do you think there's any... So I had one other theory about the end with the music box. So again, that final shot... By the way, I discovered something. I don't know if this is in the wiki that you read or not, Paul. But when I was listening to, you know, driving around at work, listening to the soundtrack, I got to thinking, you know what? I think this came with a book. So when I got home, I hunted it up and I read the liner notes. And the liner notes were fascinating because it wasn't really about the score. It was about the film, which usually the liner notes are all about, you know, this track was written this way, this track was written. And that this was not that. This was more of the nuts and bolts of making the movie, which was really interesting because I don't know that exists anywhere else. I don't think there's like a making of book or anything. But anyway, long story short, the house was constructed for this movie. So that was not an existing house. And the interiors of the house was a set that they built. I found that fascinating because it's beautiful. And I totally bought it that it was some creepy old house that they found somewhere. You know, somebody location scouted it and used it. But that made me question, like, well, then what burned at the end of the movie? Well, apparently it was, you know, this faux thing that they built. They could turn around and burn it down. So anyway, again, that final shot of the movie, we see the smoking ruins and the wheelchair, and the music box starts to play. The only other way I could interpret that would go down a little easier for me is that now it's fake Joseph is the ghost haunting the because he's been, you know, replaced, you know, ghost Joseph's been replaced by the old man because he pulled his goat, you know, his spirit there and placed him in that purgatory. But is there evidence for that? Does that wash? What do you guys think of that idea?
I think that's as good an answer as anything. I mean, we could also say it was the daughter all along. You know, like she plopped up and said, "Hey, here I am." It was my music box. I think this is an example of something where you can interpret it a lot of different ways. Actually, I was just to myself nodding along to their explanation going, "I don't know. I don't disagree with any of that." It's kind of interesting. You did mention the facade, and I saw that on IMDb too. They said that cost around $200,000 to create, which in 1980 was a decent chunk of change to plop down on crafting a facade that they put on a modern dwelling. They actually put it on another a house to make all that happen.
It says that in the Wikipedia page. It says the senator's home, exterior shots of Russell's home were filmed using a facade erected in front of an existing home in South Vancouver. The haunted mansion's interior was a series of interconnected sets at Panorama Film Studios in West Vancouver, which I guess, you know, this was a Canadian film, by the way.
Yeah. Apparently from, I don't know if it's in the wiki article or in the liner notes that I read, but that was the director's idea. And they shot him down. They were like, we don't have the money to do that. So he said, well, if you're not going to do it that way, then I'm not interested. And that night, they slipped a note under his door saying, no, you're right. We're going to do it then. And they gave him the money to do it. So, yeah, if they hadn't capitulated, I guess this guy wouldn't have ended up directing the movie. And, you know, who knows what it ended up looking like. But I'm so impressed finding out that, you know, that especially the interior of the place was just a set, because you talk about some excellent, you know, set direction and all. I mean, I totally bought it. I thought it was some creepy old house.
Yeah.
That's really all I've got on the notes on this. What else did you have, Paul? What did you think of the ending, Paul?
See, I interpreted it as now Joseph is at rest, that his death has been avenged, even though it was avenged by killing the person who wasn't really the guilty party. But that's the way I interpreted the music box playing. It was, you know, because that's a soothing type tune. So I interpreted it that he's finally at rest and that he was in that mansion because he couldn't rest until somehow it was revealed what happened.
Right. Right. Okay.
So I like that.
I like that interpretation better than my primary one, which has always been that despite everything that happened, he's still trapped there. And I don't like that. That unsettles me.
Well, that's the goal of a horror movie.
Well, yes.
They're not always meant to make you feel warm and fuzzy inside. But I guess deep down inside, I'm an old romantic or whatever, but I tend to gravitate towards the happy ending when they let you interpret yourself what it is. I often criticize The Sopranos ending with, you know, the screen goes blank and it's, well, you decide what happened. I think it's pretty clear that the filmmaker's intentions were that was when Tony Soprano got shot and killed. And that's why it all went blank. But I, for years, I just said, no, it just ended. They were having dinner in the diner and they're all happy, because I tend to always want to have the happy ending. It's just the way I am. So I'm interpreting this as Joseph got his pound of flesh and he's now able to go and rest. So I was talking to Sean before you got on, and I was saying how I do feel that the Is It Yours scale, which I'm not going to necessarily change, is a little unfair, because Jaws 1 is a great movie. Jaws 2 is a really, really, really good movie. Jaws 3 is everything else that isn't a bad movie. So I feel like Jaws 3 is almost too expansive, and that by ranking something as a Jaws 3, it's going to almost get interpreted as, oh, you didn't like this.
Right.
And I'm like leaning heavily towards Jaws 3 with this movie, because as much as I did like it, it doesn't really have the rewatchability for me that a Jaws 2 should have. But just the same, it had a lot of good things to think about. It had very good acting performances. It created a good atmosphere for that creepy feeling. So it's a really, really solid Jaws 3. I almost feel like I need to have subcategories in Jaws 3. And perhaps we'll work on that over time and come up with some sort of way of doing that. Because I don't want people to interpret that as, oh, you're saying you didn't like it. You know, because I did like it and I'm glad I watched it. It's not a matter of, you know, oh, this, you know, I wish I had my 2 hours back in my life. No, I enjoyed watching it. It had a slow build up to it. It had a this is a movie that's made to be watched at home, I think, though. Like, the big screen really wouldn't add anything to this for me. I think it's, you know, it's got a more intimate feel to it. But it was definitely worth watching, and I definitely enjoyed it. And I'm giving it a Jaws 3 because there are movies that fit that definition that are Jaws 3 movies.
Sean? This is an interesting one for me, because I think we're in a little bit of a different place on this one. I really liked this. I think the way that it was put together, I enjoy the horror genre. And it's very rare that I see a movie that I feel like surprises me in that genre, because I think we've got certain horror tropes that the things kind of fit into certain lanes. I thought this story was gripping. I agree with you totally, Paul, on the rewatchability. Like, I don't see myself watching this over, like, it's not a feel good movie. I'm not going to like a son of a new going, hey, how about ripping out Changeling? But it is also a movie that I would not be opposed to watching again. You know, if somebody was like, hey, I want to see a horror movie and I've never seen Changeling before, this would be one to be like, oh, you've got to. I will say, if they're a horror movie fan, I'd say, you've got to see that. I think it is one of those movies where I think it surprises people. And I would be an advocate for saying you should put this on your list as something you should watch, which is where it starts to fall into the Jaws 2 category for me, with an asterisk, because I don't think this is for everybody. If you do not like the horror genre, and particularly the, you know, with some disturbing elements, because this has that, this is not for you. I would not recommend it for you. But I think if you do like that, and you like a gripping story that you just want to see until the end, This one was a nail biter. I wanted to watch it all the way through, and I did not want to stop. And that was something where it was a joy all the way through. So I would say it falls into that for that particular crowd. If you fall in that case, put an asterisk on this, that would be for you. Otherwise, I'm with you, Paul, that it would be a Jaws 3, or maybe for some people a Jaws 4. If that's not your thing, you're going to run for the hills for this one and not want to watch it. But for I fall into that crowd. So I kind of want to advocate for that crowd by my rating on this one and say that I don't disagree with anything you said at all. And I think this is one of those films that I think meets a particular need.
Yeah, I like ghost stories and I like haunted houses. My favorite theme park attraction of all time is has always been the Haunted Mansion. It's probably always going to be the Haunted Mansion. And one of the things I love about the Haunted Mansion is that it's basically a bunch of guys got together and said, what are all the things that people think of when they think of a haunted house? And they put them all in there, the cobwebs, things moving on their own, by an unseen hand, creeps and weird angles and dark corners and just spooky old creepy house, all those elements. And this movie has all of that. What really sells it again for me is the seance scene. From the beginning of the seance scene through John listening and hearing the voice on the tape, I think that's the scene that makes the movie for me. And that's what gives me the maximum chills in this movie. So, from the very first time I saw this, I was really taken with it. I've watched it, a good number of times over the years, and I think it holds up really well. For me, this is a very solid Jaws 2. I do find it rewatchable. It is not a Jaws, because there are some issues with it, and we touched a little bit on those. One of the big things that has always bothered me is that there are three big moments in the movie where I feel like we should have gotten a little bit more, and it cuts away like at the wrong time. And that's when John goes into the upstairs, finds the tub running, and then has that vision of the boy's body under the water in the tub. It instantly cuts away to the next scene. Same thing with the ball. When the ball comes down the stairs, that's one of the best creep out moments in the entire movie. Mm-hmm. And as soon as John sees the ball and has his startled reaction, we immediately cut to the next day. And then when Claire sees the wheelchair at the top of the stairs, John sees her reaction, looks to follow her gaze and sees the wheelchair, it immediately cuts to the next scene. So that's three different instances of we didn't get to see their proper reaction or the follow-up on that. And I think that's a little bit of a cheat. And I almost wonder, like, did they not know how to follow that up? Because that's kind of what it feels like. It's like we got the scare, but we didn't get the follow-up after it. The only time the movie ever really does that is after John listens to the voice on the tape, puts everything together, and comes to the realization. I love the moment where he goes and calls Claire, and then he just faints dead away on the floor. We finally get his reaction.
Yeah.
And what we didn't get in all those other scenes. And so it's little things like that, just little movie making things that I notice, on subsequent watches, things that work versus things that didn't quite work. So it's not a perfect movie. I don't know that it's an eminently quotable movie either, but I really enjoy it. And I think that the music, while not a great standalone album, for easy listening on the side, works so very effectively in the film itself. It's an incredibly creepy and haunting soundtrack. So yeah, solid Jaws 2. I really dig this one.
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit on the quotability. I'm going to walk around now and just whisper Joseph when I'm around people.
Yeah, that is really creepy.
Well,
Thank you guys for covering this. I'm really glad that you did. I'm shocked that neither one of you had seen it before and still agreed to check it out.
I consider it to be one of the joys of doing this show, that I get to see movies that I might not otherwise put into my player or stream or whatever, however I'm viewing them. It gives me an excuse to see movies that I might not have otherwise. There's probably close to zero chance that I would have caught this one without you suggesting it for the show. And I'm glad I saw it. So, again, it's one of the joys of doing this show. So I hope the listeners feel similarly. And I hope they'll give this one a shot if they haven't seen it yet, because it is, you know, it is a worthwhile experience if you like the, you know, this subgenre of horror. But in the meanwhile, thank you everybody for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Suffered a cruel loss, John Russell. You've lost a wife and child. The presence in this house is reaching out to you through that loss. The presence is very strong here. It is a child's presence. A child who is not at peace, who cannot rest. The presence is with us. We sense that you are with us. Will you talk to us? Will you communicate with us? Will you come through to us? Will you speak to us? We are here to help you. What is your name? Will you speak to us?
Yes.
What is your name? Are you the child Cora? Are you the child killed by the cold heart?
No.
What is your name?
Joseph.
Did you die in this house, Joseph? How did you die? Is there someone here you wish to communicate with?